What is up, everybody, and welcome back to the Primal King Podcast. This is episode number 85. All right, so I'm super excited for my guest today. First and foremost, this is just a really, really good guy. Secondly, he has such a cool story. We talk all the time on this podcast about, you know, how much can change just in the course of a few short years. Right? I know you've heard me talk about it over and over and over again. Well, this is yet another example of how just a few years ago, he was struggling trying to build his business, and now he's got it up to an eight-figure business, and he's done it with guns. I mean, how much cooler can it get than that? All right, now real quick, I also want to ask you, if I were to tell you right now you could go and get the most bioavailable, nutrient-dense foods on the planet, what would you think it is? Would you say, I don't know, blueberries, kale, quinoa, or however the hell you pronounce that? Nope. Now, despite what the crazy vegans want you to think and these wacko environmentalists that are trying to say that cows' farts are killing the environment, like, you got to do your own research on this, okay? I encourage you to, but when you do that research and you realize that you should be eating meat, guess what? You need to make sure you're getting it from CrossO Meats. So make sure right now, go to crossomeats.com. Get yourself an order. We'll be fully restocked again soon, but there's still some bundles available. Go to crossomeats.com. Piss off a vegan, eat a bunch of meat, live great. Hey, it's going to help out everybody. Again, crossomeats.com. All right, everybody, let's get started. So the question is this: how do we live the best life that we can with the limited amount of time that we get to be here? Is it by accumulating success and fame and fortune and everything else that society tells us that we need in order to be fulfilled? Or is it much more simple than that? My name is Derek Wilson. I'm the host of the Primal King Podcast, and we're going to be answering this as well as many other questions as we move forward. All right, welcome back, everybody. We have an awesome guest for you today. This is someone who started his business after selling his car for $7,000 and went to work building guns in his garage and has gone on to build a massive empire. He prides himself on having worked on numerous poorly built guns in the beginning, which led him to have the insane knowledge and know-how required to build better guns, and that experience has also led to his hard-earned growth in a very competitive industry. He's a huge advocate for the Second Amendment and an all-around great guy and has an awesome story. He has also now gone on to build one of the most well-known rifle companies there is. I want to introduce you to the co-owner and founder of Sons of Liberty Gunworks, Mike Milhowski. Again, Mike, I'm super excited to talk to you today, man. We've had some good conversations already.
Yeah, absolutely, man. It's like-minded people, and this is fun. I appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, for sure. So I want to go back because I know a lot of people listening to this, maybe they kind of started their business similarly, kind of bootstrapped it. You know, you hear that term, but a lot of people do that, right? And so I guess for you, did you grow up with guns? Was this always a passion? Or I guess maybe just to start with, like, what kind of got you even interested into this field, if you will?
Yeah, so I mean, I grew up with a gun in my hand. I mean, from being a kid. So whenever I'd finish my chores around the house, my dad would give me, you know, a handful of 22 ammo. I'd go sit on a tank dam and probably, you know, shoot turtles or something. That was like my reward for having, you know, cleaned up around the place or something. And I was probably 5 or 6 at the time. And I remember, you know, whether we're walking trails or we're out in the field at night or something, and telling my dad I was scared, because when you're like 5, 6, 7 years old, and it's dark and you're in the woods. I mean, the idea of lions and tigers and bears are absolutely real in your head, right? I mean, you know, in your mind, there could be a Bigfoot around the corner. And from a very young age, my dad instilled in me that, you know, if you have a good, dependable rifle, you are the most dangerous thing in the woods. And you are the apex predator. And so at a very young age, it left a huge impact on me that you can, you know, defend yourself in a good, reliable rifle, probably a good knife. You know, you'll be all right. And so I think from a very young age, having that instilled, it was just one of those things that there was a theme that carried on throughout my life. So when I had an opportunity to start doing some of the stuff, professionally, it was just kind of a natural evolution.
That's cool. So I know talking to you, you had talked about when you first kind of started getting into the business that you had, you sold a car. And I know you tell the story about like then you actually had your shop and you didn't have a car. So you actually had to have somebody give you a ride. I mean, I think that that's pretty much the definition of going all in, right? So what was that like for you? Did you have any idea back then it would look like how it does now? Or were you just a guy that wanted to build some guns and see what happened?
No, I mean, I think I always had some ideas of grandeur. I wanted to be the best rifle company in the country, you know. I did not know what that looked like. I couldn't in any way picture what like that actual volume would look like. And, you know, my idea of being busy would be, you know, staying up all night long, you know, building guns. I never pictured in my head needing forklifts to load pallets. That that wasn't how it, that wasn't what I pictured. I guess it's pretty hard to imagine something like that, right? But yeah, I sold my car. That was what my startup money was. My business partner, he had an unused building on this lumber yard. And together he wanted to do it because I think he wanted to enhance his toy collection by being in the gun business. And I wanted to be like this big rifle company, but I had no idea what that actually looked like, you know?
So what did you start with? You know, did you start with like any equipment? What did that like $7,000 or whatever you got for your car? Like what did that get you doing? Cause I know I heard you talk about kind of bartering with a guy to get some, I can't remember what it was, some type of equipment. He's like, you got to have this minimum order. And you're like, no, dude, I need like 10. Like what was that like when you first started or that story? That's a great story.
Yeah. So at the time that Sons Liberty started, we started like in like the worst gun drought at the time in history, right? So this was after like the Sandy Hook rush and everybody was crazy buying guns. And Sons Liberty actually started when all of that died down and you could hardly give a gun away, right? So everyone thought I was insane to try to start a gun business in that time period. And I probably was. But because of that though, it allowed us a little bit of access, right? So because there was a bit of a drought, some people were a little bit more willing to work with you, I guess. There was one company that if I wouldn't, they made bolts, okay? And these bolts met every single check mark on what I think is important for a well-made bolt, which is the heart of a rifle. And their minimum order was 500 pieces. And I mean, I had $7,000. I could not even begin to afford their minimum order. And so I called this guy on the phone every day for about a month. I mean, it was kind of, I was really, really, really persistent. And finally, after about a month, the guy answered the phone and said, hey, like, how do I make you go away? What do you need to stop calling me? I said, I need 10 bolts. And he said, if I sell you these 10 bolts, do you promise to only contact me through email? And I was like, done. And he did. He sold me those 10 bolts. And we were able to start off by building about, you know, all in about 10 rifles. And then with every cent we made, we just rolled it back into the company, you know, and we just kept churning it. And I mean, it was the definition of bootstrapping.
Wow. So you convinced him to do the 10. And then what, you just were able to kind of keep reinvesting and just scaling from there?
Yeah, because I mean, literally every cent that we made, we rolled back into the company. I mean, we didn't take anything. It was pretty lean. I mean, when you start out like that, you learn how to operate very lean. That's why I think till this day we still don't have a lot of ego and we don't require like big showrooms and you know none of us really drive like you know fancy cars or any of that. I mean, because you start to really appreciate every penny that you need. And when you operate lean like that, that's why we were able to grow at a geographic or a geometric rate rather. So yeah, I mean, that was pretty much it. I mean, you know, 10 guns turned into 20 and, you know, and so on and so forth.
So who were you building them for in the beginning? Was it just kind of like friends and family? Was it, you know, people that like, were you advertising? Cause I'm always like, just so, And one of the reasons why I ask is because I know a lot of people are like, okay, I just don't even know how to start, right? I don't know if I'm going to start a business. Like, where am I going to go? What am I going to do with it? And like, even by you just sharing this, I think hopefully it kind of helps people get an understanding of like, okay, yeah, you can start with 10, you know, whatever it is, right? Products, widgets, whatever it is that you're doing. And 10 can be 20, 20 to 40, and it can grow kind of exponentially that way. But were you just kind of out like trying to sell them, or were there actually people that were like, yeah, I know that, you know, I want Mike to build me a gun, or how was that?
Yeah. So there is a quantifiable difference, you know, in rifles that you see. So for people that actually understand specs and for people that demand a little bit more performance out of the gun, you can kind of explain what you're doing and why you're doing it. That's the most important thing, if you can explain why. And because of that, we started getting orders. So my best friend, I consider my big brother, he was still active in the SEAL teams at the time, and he was actually kind of one of our co-founders. So some of the first guns we built were for team guys, and then, you know, some Marines, you know, guys out in that area in San Diego, especially that, you know, knew a little bit about rifle performance, and we started filling that niche. And that gave us, I think, a lot of legitimacy to launch, because when people would ask those guys, you know, what kind of gun they should, you know, what kind of gun should I go buy? It's kind of like getting, you know, advice from Tiger Woods if you were to ask what kind of putter you should buy, right? Yeah. You know? And so we started in that area, and it just kind of branched out. And I got extremely active on social media. I would join every group I could think of and start talking about guns, why this stuff matters. And I was extremely transparent about what we were doing. I there was no secret sauce. There was nothing that I thought was proprietary, or secret to what we were doing. I explained the why of everything we did. If you treat people really well and you put out a really good product, you know, people tell their friends about that. And that's how we grew into a national brand without ever spending any money in advertising. I mean, till this day, we spend virtually no money in advertising.
Mostly like social media, or, well, I know now you have more contracts and probably a lot of referral stuff, but was it mainly just social media initially?
Yeah, mainly. See, back then, whenever we started, remember, we're about 6 years old. So back then, if you had 1,000 followers on Facebook and you put up a post, 1,000 people saw it. You know, you could create a video of cool content, and then, you know, people actually saw it. You could discuss guns and components and pricing without being banned. So, I mean, in the early days of social media, it was actually very good for us. I don't know if you could do that today, right? I mean, I think in our space, it might be really hard to find, to build a following organically, right? Because, you know, we couldn't boost. Even back then, you couldn't boost, you couldn't advertise. So there were a lot of hurdles there. Really what it took, man, is just, it took 20 hours a day. It's like 20 hours a day of, I spent a lot more time talking about guns online than I did actually building guns, because, you know, we didn't have a lot of customers back then. But eventually we kind of established ourselves as guys that knew what they were talking about. And then, you convince somebody to buy your product. They saw that the product performed really well. They tell their friends about it. And that's just kind of how it goes. It's a really condensed version of a really painstaking process of how to grow whenever you have nothing.
Yeah. How long did that process last for? Was that, are we talking years, or was that months before it really kind of got the snowball rolling?
Well, that's just it. I mean, we established ourselves in like certain communities kind of early on, and that certainly helps, right? And then we started focusing, you know, in our own geographic region, like in our city. And then that started growing, you know, and rippling out. So from San Antonio, like surrounding areas, we actually did the gun show circuits. We, you know, every time we saw an opportunity to, like, again, remember, we had nothing, right? But there were times where I saw somebody do something newsworthy, or they were on the news for doing something that I thought was like patriotic or heroic. And we would get in touch with that guy and send them a gun. You know, and this was no little thing. I mean, this might have been like the last bit of inventory we had, but I had two reasons for that. One, I thought it was neat to reward people with guns, you know, and I think it's good for the culture. Another thing too is that, I mean, if you can't afford advertising, you kind of have to get creative, and that was pretty much our advertising budget, was sending guns to the right cool people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it's funny because and
one more thing that we did too, even when we were very young, I mean, we were not on anybody's radar. I would contact a lot of these places that did reviews, and I'd ask them, hey, can I send you a gun? Like, go beat the shit out of it. I'm not asking for a puff piece. I don't want you to say anything. I'm not asking you to say anything nice about us. I want you to give me a legit no shit objective review of the gun. And so we would send guns out to people, you know, trying to find something wrong with it. And that, of course, also helped. I mean, that was, you know, that played up, I think, a big role in the very early days.
Yeah. Yeah. I know that one of the strategies that I've heard a couple of people that I know talk about that are very successful is what they call the Dream 100. I don't know if it's something you've ever heard of, but basically they say to sit down, write out the 100 people that if you could get your product into their hands, that it would, you know, help your business grow, and write a list of it down and figure out how to get that in their hands. And if your product's good enough, obviously they like it, they accept it, whatever, that can be some of the best form of marketing you can ever do. And I mean, it sounds like basically you were kind of doing something similar to that way back before this strategy was probably ever even known of.
Yeah. I mean, I think some of the stuff we did was a bit intuitive, and then some of it was just, you don't have really any other options. I mean, and we did crazy stuff too. I mean, like from day one, we made a deal where if you were to damage or destroy one of our guns, even through your own fault, we'd replace it. So we wanted to establish ourselves as having like the best end user support. And this stuff came at a great cost. I mean, you like back then, if somebody shot out a barrel or something, you know, we sold one to like a machine gun rental range, and then they, you know, shot out a barrel or something, like that meant you might not, you know, you might not eat, you know, having to replace that thing, right? But to me, the integrity of the brand was more important than anything. And I never measured our success in money. I always measured our success in seeing how many rifles were leaving. And that was it. I mean, till this day, I still don't look at the money. I look at the footprint, you know, I look at the map of not just the United States, but, you know, of a few countries and say, hey man, that's our idea. We did this.
That's awesome. Has there ever been a point now that you've kind of, you know, you've grown the way that you have and you've grinded for so long? I mean, has there been a point where you've kind of sat back and be like, damn, like we kind of made it, like we're where we hoped we would be, you know, 6 years ago?
Sometimes. And then you get humbled really quick, right? So there's times when I'll get a phone call from like a celebrity, you know what I mean, like a legitimate celebrity that wanting to buy a gun. And it's a cool feeling because it's almost like that celebrity asking you for your autograph, right? I mean, it's kind of cool. And then I can get in my car and drive 20 minutes from the shop and walk into a gun shop, and the guy behind the counter has never heard of us, you know? And it's immediately humbling, and it reminds you every day that like you haven't made it. And I'm not sure you ever actually do. There's always some challenge. There's always something, you know, and we're in a very competitive cutthroat industry. So every day we're competing against somebody, and, you know, every day you have victories and losses. So.
Well, and that was, I mean, one of the things I was going to ask you, because it is such a competitive industry, and you know, it seems like there has been kind of this push, like patriotic, and I think Black Rifle Coffee has kind of pushed some of this stuff. I think Joe Rogan, maybe with his massive reach in the firearms and kind of the hunting industry. And it seems like there's kind of been a push that way. So for you guys to maybe stay relevant, stay where you're at, are you having to innovate like different things, or is it kind of just more of the same and continue doing great stuff? Or are you guys trying to figure out maybe different ways of kind of staying ahead of the market?
Yeah. So, I mean, we make one of the most robust and reliable guns on the market. You know, that's without question. In terms of performance, there's a very short list of companies that actually do stuff like that right. So sticking to that formula is key. I'd rather almost be a boringly reliable company than to try to, you know, expand and then do stuff. I don't want to put stuff out for the sake of it being marketable. I don't want to put stuff out for the sake of it being new. If we do put stuff out, it's because I think we've legitimately improved something. We've made something better. So yeah, we're constantly incrementally trying to improve the gun. We're constantly trying to improve all kinds of things. Right now, I'm very excited because we're in a position now to where I think we can start branching into a few other things. I mean, I do defensive rifles professionally, but like my passion is hunting. It always has been. It's been my favorite thing to do since I was a kid. That like I could, when the seasons would change, I could count down the days till, you know, spring turkey or dove or to, you know, whatever. And so we are going to be doing some stuff, I think, in that arena. We're going to be taking a lot of what we learned here in this area and pushing a little bit into that. And then I'm as excited about that as I was about Suns Liberty. So no, we do innovate. We do keep things growing, but you can't ever lose the core of what made you, you know, you can't ever lose sight of that.
But yeah, I think it's kind of the McDonald's versus the Apple, right? And that's why it's always fascinating, because I think there's more than one way to do this. I mean, McDonald's, it's like 20 years ago, basically is the same thing today. And the way they grow is by putting more McDonald's out there, right? They stick to their little philosophy. You're not going to start up a McDonald's franchise and start serving pancakes and waffles. It's like, you know, Big Macs in that cell, right? Whereas Apple, it's like every couple of years, they've got to have a newer phone, a better camera. And so it's always just interesting because, I don't know, there's kind of something part of me, maybe it's like a traditional old school. It's like, man, if you can do something awesome and do it better than anybody else, you may not have to innovate like Apple does, right? And again, it's a different industry, but it is kind of cool seeing being like, basically, hey, like, we're going to do the best and you guys are probably going to like it. So no, that's great stuff. Now I want to ask you,
there's a couple things in that, you know, so Apple's one of those brands to where you can probably reach like some level of market saturation, right? So at some point, like, let's just say 50% of every cell phone user in the world has an Apple. I don't know if I'm not saying those numbers are correct, but for the sake of the conversation, let's just say, and so if you have saturated a certain market with your product, then you probably do have to come out with something new, you know, every couple of years in order to expand growth. For us, like, we're nowhere near that, right? I mean, if you look at like our impact on the industry, for a long time we satisfied such like a small niche of like professional end users and really sophisticated shooters, and now we're kind of branching out a little bit more mainstream. So I mean, we have a ton of market share left to capture just by doing what we do, you know. Mm-hmm. Now I mean, ask me that question 10 years from now and you know, maybe there's some strategy changes that we have to have, but I think there's such a huge market share we can still tap into. So that's, you know, that's one thing. And I'll tell you this too, man, there's a lot of companies that I've seen, I'm not going to name any names, but there are gun companies that I respect that as they've grown have lost some of that QC and some of that performance because the decisions are no longer being made by shooters. The decisions are being made by dudes in pleated trousers with calculators, right? Yep. And so you can outgrow that magic. And so for us, I mean, holding on to that magic, I think is really important. That's why, you know, till this day, I mean, the decisions that we make as a brand or as a company are still made by wrench turners and shooters. So this, I didn't mean to go off on a rant, man, but like, you know, the Apple comparison is good. It's just, like you said, it's a different market, you know?
Yep. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So for the people who don't know, because one of the things that I do want to ask you is the name of your company. I think a lot of people are like, Sons of Liberty Gunworks, that's cool. You know, Sons of Liberty, but they probably don't actually know that there's a meaning behind that. So if you wouldn't mind, would you tell everybody kind of what the meaning is behind the company name?
Yeah. So Sons of Liberty Gunworks was actually the Sons of Liberty were the founders, or the, I guess, the secret society, like that started like in 1765, that kind of were the catalyst of the, you know, the American Revolution. They were the guys that would meet in secret and, you know, plan and plot, you know, really, so like Sam Adams and Paul Revere and Thomas Jefferson. And, you know, there's a lot of guys that were in the original Sons of Liberty that there's quite a bit. If you look at our shipping labels till this day, every week we change the shipping label from name to one of the original Sons. And it's disappointing how many people don't catch that. I guess in American history, that stuff's not taught as much as it used to be. And I'll be honest, in some circles, and I know when we started doing agency contracts, I had like police chiefs and stuff ask if that was like a motorcycle gang. I was like, no, just the founders.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and I found that to be so fascinating, right? Because I don't know, there's a lot of people that kind of wonder what's going on, you know, kind of like you and I were talking about even before we started recording here, just some crazy stuff going on, right? And, you know, it's, I think, more important than ever to understand history and understand how things get to where they do. And the fact that you kind of have that throwback, you know, with your company name is awesome. And I kind of want to get your take on that, because I know that, at least based on what I've seen, you guys aren't like super political, but obviously when you're in the gun industry and there's always, it seems like, pushes that kind of coming at guns, depending on what's what, like, how do you play that? How do you skirt? Do you just say the hell with it? I'm going to say what I want. Do you try to toe the line a little bit and be somewhat quote unquote politically correct?
No, not at all. So we're not a sterile brand, you know, we're really not. And a lot of the industry is sterile, and that's fine. You know, I will never tell somebody how to run their business. I do think that this is how we make a living. And if you can't stand up for even that, even on self-serving reasons as to why I would support gun causes, or oppose anti-gun causes, even on a self-serving reason. Right. But I mean, I'm in this business because I ideologically believe in it. Like I said, from when I was a kid, I think a good rifle will get you through a lot. You know, I think it's one of the things about being self-reliant, right? So no, I learned a lesson early on in my career, and that was that I could be as polite as I wanted, and I could be as PC as I wanted, and the other side is not going to like me, no matter what I do. I can say whatever, I can jump through whatever hoops. Like, if you're an anti-gun person through and through, you're not going to like me. So instead of trying to appease those people, which I put zero effort in, I kind of push all in for my side. And so no, we support pro-gun political candidates. We're very active in, like, there was a town hall here not long ago where the city was proposing a gun buyback, and these town halls normally, you know, like 25 people usually show up for them, right? It's people that don't have cable or some shit, right? They, you know, we brought 500 people, you know, to oppose this gun buyback, and it did. We won. We've gone to Virginia where they had like their lobby day. I mean, so we're very active. Now, with that being said, the only politics that I really ever get involved in isn't party line politics. I'm not in there trying to like root for, you know, Trump or root against Trump or something like that. I mean, you know, people can probably guess which way I lean. But the only time we ever get involved is when it involves a gun issue, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I don't debate abortion or immigration or healthcare. I don't get involved in that stuff. It's not my wheelhouse, and that's not my place. But when it comes to a gun issue, you could bet your ass we're going to be involved in that, outspoken. I have volunteered my company to be plaintiffs in court cases. You know, I mean, if not us, who? You know, if not a gun company named Sons of Liberty, who, you know?
Well, I think that the challenge that I see so often now is it's kind of profit above all else. Right. And believe me, like I'm all about making money, and I'm all about making as much of it as you can, because the truth is, kind of like the old saying goes, like, poor people usually aren't going to give you a job. We need people to make money. We need businesses to be able to thrive. But the thing that I worry about is that because of that, we've almost stopped speaking truth, right? Like if you believe in guns, I think it should be cool to be like, hey, I believe in guns and I believe in this, or I believe in that policy and everything else. But I think so many people anymore are so terrified of speaking their mind because it might affect their bottom line. And so I'm always curious about this. And I'm not saying that the way that we do it is better, or the way that I do it. I know I piss people off all the time and I don't really care, but I also know that that's not necessarily the right way. And so it's always just fascinating, because I also know very, very successful people that are like, you know what? People don't follow me. They don't buy from me because of my political views or because of my values and stuff like that. They buy from me because of what I provide. And I mean, that's cool too. I just worry that if we have too many people saying that, you know, will we lose our right to own guns? Will we lose our right to do this or that or the other? Right. And so it is always like, is pretty much everybody in your company then, would you say that they're pretty much, obviously they're bought into guns, but do you guys mostly see the same ways, or do you get some good debates like on some of that stuff within your company?
Yeah. I mean, the people we hire are all pretty independent thinking, you know, kind of free spirited people. Like I don't think you can find two or three people anywhere on the planet that agree on everything. Yeah. Right. I mean, there are, I mean, you know, when it comes to guns and gun issues, I can honestly say we're all probably pretty in line. When it comes to a lot of other stuff, we're not. I mean, I think people have this misconception of me that I'm like really far right wing. I'm not. I'm actually not. You know, I'm very much. I hate to use the word libertarian, because I think that word has become so butchered and bastardized. So I mean, I'm not going to say that, but I wouldn't consider myself like, you know, a hardcore right leaning person for the most part. When it comes to guns, I have a very, very hard line. And as far as speaking out against it, look, Sons of Liberty is kind of an extension of my personality. And I shouldn't say just mine. It's all of us, our whole crew. It's an extension of our personality. It's kind of it is a little rough around the edges. You know, it is a bit irreverent. And we take our work very seriously. We don't take ourselves very seriously. There's a lot of humor in what we do. There's a lot of, we've been blessed with this platform, you know, to say stuff and reach people. And I've noticed that our following is really engaged. We don't have a passive following. You know, on social media, I learned this lesson very early on. There's a difference between a passive following and an active following. Like, you might have a million passive followers that really don't give a shit what you say. Maybe they're checking you out because you got big tits, or maybe, you know, that, you know, they watch you for the humor, right? Our following is super active. And if the reason we were able to bring 500 people to a town hall meeting was because of that. So I think it would be a shame to waste that megaphone. And, you know, if I say something that offends somebody, then perhaps we're not the right gun company for you. I mean, you know,
yeah.
And I can live with that. And I can live with that.
Yeah. Well, and part of it too is if someone's offended by you advocating for gun rights, they're probably not your customer anyways. They're probably not actually in the gun world anyways, if they're offended by, I don't know, some policies maybe, or some stuff like that that you're involved in. Now, as far as kind of looking forward, because you've done such an awesome job, obviously building your business to where you are, getting to where you've been with, you know, with kind of the beginning and everything else. Do you foresee yourself, like, is this kind of the long game for you? Like, just running and building this business? Do you have maybe other things? I know you talked about getting more into the hunting space and stuff like that, but still kind of within the same business. Like, do you see this being something that you want to do forever? Or do you ever think, hey man, maybe I'll ride off into the sunset and do something else?
I honestly don't know what I'd do with myself. You know, I don't know what, I mean, I love this stuff. I love talking about guns. I love shooting guns. I love seeing our guns make a difference. I mean, our guns have been in places that have legitimately made a difference, you know, where someone's life depended on it, and our gun helped that user prevail. And I got to tell you, that's rewarding. And I don't know what I would do. This is something that I really, really care about. I see a lot of people that make a ton of money and they hate their jobs or they hate their lives. They, you know, they're not satisfied. Like this, I would do it for free. If I won the lottery tomorrow, I would still come to work. You know, I really do love this. So, and here's another truth about the gun industry too, is that, like, there's not a whole lot of exit strategies. Usually you don't see gun companies sell at their peak. It's rare. You know, most time when you see a gun company sell, someone's buying it out of like insolvency or something. So, I mean, I can't imagine somebody coming to us with some kind of crazy offer, but even if they did, I just don't know what else I'd do with my time.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I do invest in other things. I am involved in other ventures, but I can't see myself being out of the gun business.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, I know. I think that's kind of to me, like almost a definition of fulfillment, right? Is that kind of like you said, if I won the lottery today, what would I do tomorrow? And most people are like, I would flip off my boss and tell him I'm out of here. You know, I would buy a car on my way home. And you're like, I just go back to work again tomorrow. And so there's got to be some peace in that, right?
Yeah, it's extremely rewarding. I believe in what we're doing. And I think we're making a difference. You know, not just by, I think we build parachutes, for the lack of a better word, right? You know, a parachute can't work most of the time. You know, it has to work every time. And we're building weapons so that people are going to count on one day, maybe to defend their family or to defend their home. And I take that, I feel some duty to that, you know, to protect their way of life.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can make a buck doing it, you know, I get to travel all around the world. I meet incredible people. I find myself in rooms that I never would have imagined with, you know, because because of my industry, and it's really cool. I got some great.
You got a name drop. Who are you hanging out with?
Well, I mean, I've got to meet a lot of interesting, you know, celebrities and political leaders and, you know, people that I'm fans with, you know. Through a gun thing, you know, I mean, I got to meet Joe Rogan. That was really cool. Nice. Sat and chatted with that cat for a while, man. Super, super nice guy. I mean, I don't mind mentioning that because there's pictures all over the internet. So, I mean, there's just a lot of stuff. And we've also got to work on some neat projects that, that I'm very proud of that, you know, one day I'd like to talk about.
Yeah. What do you got going on? Or is it something you can't mention yet?
Well, here's something cool. So we were involved with this is open source. So, the Air Force, the 366 Fighter Air Wing wanted to, they were about to deploy to Syria. And, you know, for the first time in history, there's no POW camp. If you got shot down over Syria, you're probably getting your head cut off on Al Jazeera or something, right? And historically, you know, pilots flew with like an M9, a pistol, a Beretta on their body. And they wanted something to match the standoff distance of an AK, to which they determined about 350 meters. And so they wanted to put a little bit more firepower in their aircraft if they had to eject. And the Air Force was working on a project. They only had a few weeks to solve this problem. And it was putting, you know, a rifle under their bailout seat. In the very first iteration of that rifle that actually flew into combat, you know, I had a small piece in helping, tiny piece, but I got to help with that project. I got a challenge coin out of the deal, you know, but it felt good knowing that if that pilot needed that rifle, it was going to work.
How cool. Yeah. I mean, that's where it gets into stuff bigger than you, right? I would have to imagine, at least like when you're helping take care of troops and you're helping, you know, I know you do, you guys provide a fair amount of rifles and stuff and guns for law enforcement, right?
Yeah. All over the country. I'm pretty sure we're in use in almost every state for law enforcement. Yep. And that, again, that's satisfying too. I mean, I've seen, again, you know, reports on the news, this, you know, some guy's holding his family hostage, you know, some guy's a fugitive from justice because he's wanted on child molestation, or he's a convicted child molester or something, and the guy's running from the law, and then he decides to, you know, put up a fight and he lost. That's okay with me. I can live with that.
Well, how do you reconcile too, and it is something that I wonder about, is knowing that even on the other end of that, right? Like inevitably good guys get guns, but also bad guys get guns. And, you know, there's a chance that guns maybe that you're making end up, because I know that this is always going to be the argument for the other side. And so almost like devil's advocate, I guess, which is, you know, how do you reconcile the fact that maybe some of the guns that you do create ended up in the wrong hands and they end up doing terrible things? I mean, is that something that you think about, or how do you reconcile that?
All the time. And whenever I see a high profile shooting on the news, dude, the first thing that goes through my mind is, you know, please don't let that be one of ours. And then, you know, you wait, because if your gun is used in some kind of incident, the ATF usually contacts you immediately for a, you know, disposition request. And, you know, and of course, we're watching when they release the idiot's name to see if he was, you know, someone, you know, from us, that bought something from us. Yeah, trust me, it's a hard, it's a tough thing, you know. And I accept the fact that our guns could be used for something bad, but overwhelmingly, and I'm talking like, it would be a truly anomalous event for one of our guns to be used in, you know, for evil. Number one, AR-15s just aren't used in that many murders. But I mean, they're just not. Yeah,
unfortunately, unless you watch the media, then they're in every murder, it seems like, right?
Well, that's a bunch of horseshit.
Oh, it's crazy.
But if you actually look at the real crime data statistics, if you actually look at what the real world data is, unmanipulated, unfiltered, okay, rifles of any kind are exceedingly rare in murders.
It's almost always handguns, right?
I mean, yeah, handguns are going to be usually the choice of, you know, dudes robbing liquor stores or dudes, you know, shooting each other over a, you know, $15 bag of crack or something. Right? I mean, so Number one, just on that alone, it's exceedingly rare to see an AR-15 used in a homicide, with the exception of like the high profile cases, to which there's probably more Powerball winners than there are true mass shooters, right? Okay, so there's that. Another thing too, as a brand, our target demographic really are like people who shoot a lot and people who train. And if you look at these fuckheads that go and shoot up, you know, shopping malls and schools, they're not gun people. No. Okay, because I always go, dude, I mean, this is part of my unfortunate little ritual. I go look at them. I go find their Facebook page before it gets taken down. And I go see who they followed. And you know what? Every time, they don't follow any gun pages. They don't follow any gun personalities, none of the gun influencers. They don't. They usually went and bought that gun like a day or two before they decided to go off the farm. And so gun people don't do these things. And we, our clients, are gun people. You know, they're actual shooters. They're people that probably, you know, nerd out on specs and stuff like that. So, I mean, that's good. I mean, I think the bigger we get, the more mainstream we get, the more and more places that carry our guns, the probability of something like that happening is there. But the alternative is to not ship any guns.
Yeah.
And that to me is way, way more detrimental to what I think America is than if one of our guns was in some anomalous way used in a crime. Yeah, the other side, their solution is, you know, ban everything. And my solution is, you know, I hope one of our rifles kills that dude if he pulls some shit, you know, in a mall, you know?
Well, and I've heard people float the theory, and I kind of have mixed reactions to it, because part of me is like, hell yeah, and the other part is like, that'd be a damn disaster. But it's almost like, just give everyone a gun. Maybe that would stop so much of the crap that goes on. It's like, maybe you wouldn't go and mess with that guy if you knew he had a gun, right? Like, if everyone could defend themselves, I don't know. It's a crazy theory. I've heard people talk about it, but there is something in knowing that, like, you know,
you're not too far off, man. If you go look at the places that are the prime targets to go try to shoot a lot of people, man, it's churches, it's grocery stores, it's schools, you know, it's office buildings. It's places that are gun-free zones, you know,
very low resistance, right? I mean, you wouldn't probably go to, I don't know, like an NRA rally or a biker rally or something. You never see them happening in places like that. And so that's what makes me wonder. And even going back, I'm going to say I'm not that old, right? Like, I graduated 20 years ago, and we had people, and again, I went to a small town, rural town, but we had people everywhere with guns in their vehicles. You weren't really supposed to, but I mean, everyone had guns. We all went deer hunting after practice, you know, after football in the fall. It was like, hop up in your pickup and you go deer hunting. And so having guns was never the problem. And so that's why I always have such a hard time with these arguments, is getting access to guns to me is something that, like, we've had access to guns forever. Why does it seem like, you know, they just keep getting in the wrong hands, I guess, if you want to call it that. But again, it's like, what's the root cause of why people are doing this? Not what the tool is that they're using to do it, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, I have this conversation all the time. And if you look at I'm not talking about gun deaths, right? Because, I mean, we all know that about 65% of every gun death in America is a suicide. So that's an entirely separate issue. That's not a gun issue. That's somebody who's committed to die issue. Okay. Yep. And that's an entirely separate conversation about mental health and all kinds of stuff. But if you look at real gun homicide, I'm not talking about self-defense shooting. I'm talking about, you know, murder, okay? Murder with a firearm. The vast majority of murder with a firearm is committed, like, in most of your inner city stuff, okay? It's, it's true. I mean, I read a lot of this stuff. I study it. I observe it. I pay probably closer attention to it than most. I look at it like this, okay? Imagine how desperate and hopeless you must feel if you would kill somebody over $20, okay? Now, I'm not excusing the murderer at all. I'm just saying, how hopeless and fucked up must your life be that you would murder somebody, you know, the liquor store clerk or a dude, you know, over a bag of grass or something, man? Like, how fucking horrible must your life be if you would risk going to prison and living in a cage and never eating good food and never having sex with a real woman. If you would risk all of that for forever over like $20, that's not a gun problem, man. That's like that's a poverty problem. That's an economic problem. Okay. That's a cultural problem. That's there's a lot of stuff going on. So if somebody wanted to get to the root cause of why people have the propensity to commit murder in the first place, that would be a worthwhile endeavor to maybe study, you know, to me.
That's hard. That's hard to talk about that because that actually has nuance to it, right? It's not just ban guns and all murder stops. It's like, you actually have to get into the nuance of, like you said, the cultural problems, the economic problems, the mindset problems, right? Like, again, like I see people who will go and just locally, we had somebody rob a restaurant and there's a couple $1,000 and I'm just like you have to be in such a bad spot in your life to go and risk going to prison over a couple $1,000 that I can't even comprehend it, right?
Yeah, I can't either. I mean, I live a life that, I wouldn't risk it over really any amount of money. I love my kids. I would not be able to see them again. You look at somebody that is truly hopeless. And then the flip side of that coin is like some of these high profile mass shooters that have walked into schools and stuff. A lot of these people are known to authorities, right? I mean, a lot of these guys have been interviewed by the FBI. They've had local law enforcement step in. If you talk to their roommates and their ex-girlfriends and their friends, nobody's terribly shocked. They went and did something fucking nuts. Okay. Yeah. And I don't believe in red flag laws because I believe in due process, and in due process is such a core part of what America is. Right. But that does not mean there can't be other means of intervention. I mean, I wonder sometimes if you have this kid who is displaying some really kooky, potentially violent behavior, like why not some kind of organization that takes that guy out for a beer, or just talks to him, takes him fishing. I don't know, introduces him to some girls. I don't know. But if you look at like some of these really high profile mass shooter guys, they're always, they're very isolated. They're very lonely. They're socially awkward. They have no friends. They don't have much going for them. And our side talks about, some kind of intervention or, there's no mechanism to do that without violating due process. What if there was some other solution? I guess when I start proposing solutions to these problems, it has nothing to do with taking guns away. It has nothing to do with that. I do acknowledge there is a problem.
Well, and there's absolutely. No, I think that there's absolutely is a problem. But again, it comes back to the solution. The easy way, again, is just grab the guns, right? Because if no one has guns, then no one will have guns. But we know that's not how it's going to work.
No, and that's just it. I mean, first of all, I would oppose any gun law. I want that to be clear, okay? But for the sake of this conversation, if somebody proposed a law that actually would save lives, it might be worth a conversation. But absolutely nothing I've ever heard proposed is meaningful in any way other than some kind of feel-good reactionary type of gesture. It's all a stupid gesture, I mean, but that has become our culture in a nutshell. This whole COVID bullshit, I don't mean to go off on some kind of other tangent, but like this whole COVID thing that we saw, I mean, I believe the virus is absolutely real. I mean, there's no denying that COVID exists. But if you look at some of the solutions proposed, it was lock everybody down, no matter what,
crazy.
Everybody's
crazy,
you can't go fishing. You can't go out, you can't go hiking. You need 3 masks. That was some people's solution to a problem that was 99.9% survivable. Okay. And I was kind of hoping that all these people that were seeing that were seeing data manipulated, that were seeing the fear mongering on the news, that had their businesses affected by shutting down their restaurants for no good reason. I was kind of hoping that would be the wake up call that the media lies, shit's pushed for agendas. Okay. Data's manipulated. Fear, well-intentioned people can be controlled by fear if they're misinformed, and I thought that maybe we might pick up a few allies in this fight for the gun thing, simply by how much bullshit we saw during the COVID thing. And I, that hope went away when I realized that there was a lot of people that enthusiastically lost their businesses, enthusiastically gave up their livelihoods, you know, because, and so.
Have you heard of, along those lines, and I had her on the podcast a few weeks back, but her name is Lindsey Graham, and she owned a business in Oregon that got a lot of attention. You ever heard her story?
I don't know.
Telling you, man, her name's Lindsey Graham. She's a hairstylist and salon owner. I had her on the podcast probably like 2 months ago. She's been on national news. They call her like the Patriot Barbie. Her story is nuts. All she did was just want to open her business because she was literally losing everything that she had worked her life for. And I mean, to me, it's very logical when she goes through, like, you know, we had like 5 locations and we had a great business and we were in downtown Salem, Oregon, I believe is where it was. And it was just like, we just got to the point to where it's like, we have to open our doors or we're going to go bankrupt. And it wasn't just the government that came at it. It was other people. And that was where you start realizing, you know, and I've heard it called fear porn before, right? It's like people literally get addicted to this fear stuff and they just can't let it go. It's almost like they get so enamored with being scared that anything that could scare them, it just, like, it's almost like they find comfort in some weird way. And like you said, I thank God I live the way that I do, or else I don't know how I would have survived the last year. I mean, I've done everything I normally would do, but some of these people in an apartment in New York City, how the hell they're not killing themselves. I mean, I would go crazy being bottled up in a little tiny apartment with a bunch of kids. I have 4 kids. I mean, I couldn't even imagine what it would look like after a year of being locked down like that.
But they are killing themselves and they're drinking themselves to death, and domestic violence is through the roof. And there's all these secondary, there's the unintended consequences from it that nobody wants to talk about. Like, the lockdown has been incredibly destructive for a lot of people's lives.
Yeah.
Again, I'm not trying to get off on a tangent or something, but I mean, that is the perfect example of the battle that we have in our industry for years. I heard restaurant owners pleading to their mayor to look at the data, that, hey, restaurants are not super spreaders. People aren't, dying from coming to restaurants. That people should have the option to do their own kind of risk assessment and what they want to do. And I heard all this and it sounded really familiar. Sounds a lot like the battle that we have fought for the last, 40 or 50 years. And I remember wanting to stand like in solidarity with those people, hoping that perhaps, they would understand our plight. But I don't think so. I think we're so entrenched in camps at this point, man, that I don't know. And even though gun ownership, the demographic is growing. I mean, the largest segment of the population that for gun ownership is minorities and women and LGBT. I think those communities are buying guns faster than, your typical right wing straight white male guy. Right. Does that necessarily mean that, that they might vote for politicians that protect gun rights? I don't know. What I'm hoping is not so much to change anybody's politics, but perhaps, the political platforms of some of these people will be less enthusiastic about, banning guns. Mm-hmm. Perhaps keep your leftist views on certain things, but leave guns out of it. And if that happens, then I would consider that some victory for us, if gun control is taken off the table right now, it feels like they're doubling down. It feels like there's a big disconnect. I don't think Biden has the political jack to actually ban guns. I don't think he's gonna be able to get 60 votes on that, right? So unless they start fucking with the filibuster, or unless they legitimately pack the courts, I think we're safe there. The stuff that keeps me up at night isn't so much Joe Biden, it's Facebook, it's Visa, it's Bank of America, it's PayPal, it's Instagram, it's Salesforce, it's Quicken. I mean, it's all of these massive, massive companies that we've come to rely on, they don't like us. And there's no one to appeal to, right? I mean, if Facebook turns you off, who do you go complain to? Yeah. There was a time whenever if you were the little guy, you could go to the news would plead your case for you. Well, the media is not necessarily on our side. And I got to tell you, it's hard to do interstate. I mean, we're an international business. Okay. We're not a local business. It's hard to do business over state lines and in different states and in, you know, different countries if you without the support of banking institutions. You know, Google, you know, Google AdWords, you can't use that. There's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of traditional tools. I mean, insurance. There's only like, there's very few companies that will insure a gun manufacturer. And if they can charge you whatever they want because they know they're the only guys in line.
Yeah.
Again, there's a lot of little things that I think people take for granted, how hard it is to get from raw material to a functioning firearm to your hands. There's a lot of stuff that goes on in there behind the scenes that I'm not sure people really appreciate how difficult it is.
Yeah.
And then to have grown this company the way we have without the use of any of those traditional tools, and that, it's kind of cool, although yeah. It's hard to celebrate because yeah. It feels it like is. They can take it at any time.
It is. It's awesome what you've done. And I seriously, the biggest thing that I worry about, the government's one thing, but there's checks and balances, kind of like you said. I mean, Biden, all these lefties, you know, that are way out there on the gun stuff, they can do whatever they want, but it still has to get through the Supreme Court. You know, like there's at least still some checks and balances. It is like you said, it's these tech moguls that they have literally, there's no one to rein them in. They could kill your, you know, a lot of our businesses. And I know that people don't maybe understand that aren't in business how all of this stuff works, but you know, if you're getting 50% of your money for your business through PayPal and 50% through Stripe, which is a merchant processing company, and they shut you down, they have killed your business. And
yeah.
The only people that you can like basically kind of like you said, plea your case to is them. And if they say no, there's not a lot of other options. You know, if you're running a multi-million dollar business running Facebook ads and they slap you down, I have friends of mine in the internet marketing world that this has happened to over and over and over again to where you're just basically screwed. And so those are the people that really freak me out. But anyways, I know we got to wrap it up. I know Mike, your time's valuable, like I said earlier, and I've really enjoyed our conversation. On the podcast, we always try to talk about, you know, liberation, lifestyle, legacy. It's kind of the three pillars: mindset, the way that you live, and then lastly, legacy. So you've done such awesome stuff with your company, the way that you've grown it, the way that you've gotten it up there. I guess my question would be, as we do kind of start to wrap it up here, is, you know, having done everything that you've done, you've been an advocate for Second Amendment and everything that you stand for, maybe one day when you're looking back over all of this, what do you hope that your legacy will be?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I just want to have made a contribution to, you know, to the industry, right? I would like to have improved, you know, weapons for defense. And I would have liked to, I'm hoping that we can advance. I mean, I have a bill in Texas. I mean, I was instrumental in getting a bill passed in Texas. I'd like to get a few more, you know. I would like to actually make some kind of change. And I'm a regular guy. I'm a regular guy who just took a shot. And I think a lot of people can do that. You know, I don't think you have to be wealthy or you don't have to be famous. I mean, regular people make a difference all the time. And it's just a matter of, I guess, kind of just doing it, you know, just stand up and do it. So that's what I hope. I hope that I'm remembered for making good guns and having, you know, advanced or protected the Second Amendment a little bit.
Awesome. No, I think that's a great legacy. It's something that hopefully a lot of people are willing to kind of step up to that task of making sure that we can keep, you know, as I say, I love to cruise around the mountains and blow shit up. And so I hope that I can do that and my kids can do that and my grandkids, and we can carry that tradition on. So for the people that want to find you, obviously, you know, your guns speak for themselves. You know, the integrity, everything that you've done within the company, all of that is just amazing. If people want to follow you, if they want to find you, where's some of the best places they can find you at?
So as of now, as of this podcast, we are on Instagram at Sons Liberty GW, Sons Liberty Gunworks on Facebook. We're on Twitter. I am exploring some of the different, you know, platforms, you know, Rumble and that kind of stuff. So yeah, that's it, man. That's pretty much for now, we'll see.
Yeah, I know. I saw you guys put a post up the other day that was like, hopefully everything goes good, because I think you got in a little bit of Instagram trouble. But yeah, as of now, you can find them at Sons of Liberty Gun GW on Instagram. I know you've got a huge following there. And make sure that you guys check them out. Check out the website. Check out what they do. So much good stuff. Thanks again, Mike, for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Dude, thank you so much, man.
I absolutely love having you as a listener of the Primal King podcast. If you don't want to miss out on the great content, then it's time to hit that subscribe button right now. Do not be left behind. And then share your thoughts and feedback with a written review of the show. I read every single one of these, and it helps me make sure I am serving you best. It also allows others to find this content, and it builds this community. Make it an awesome day, and we'll see you next time.